This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is January 6th, 2022, and this is episode 271. I'm Scott DeLindebaum.
And I'm Stuart Prest.
Stuart, thanks for joining me today and filling in for Ian, who is unexpectedly on paternity leave a couple weeks earlier as his newest addition to the family arrived over the holidays.
That's right. It turns out baby Cassian was in a hurry to join the world before the Christmas rush. So we wish Ian and family all the best in the next chapter.
So yeah, Ian's going to be off for a couple weeks probably. He'll be filling in with a couple different guest hosts during that time. Yeah, we'll also be postponing the Greatest Premier Bracket until Ian is back. On today's show, we'll be talking about, well, the thing that everyone's been talking about over the last couple weeks, the latest goings on with the pandemic, as well as a roundup of stories from Canada and BC.
Yeah, the pandemic's still happening, huh? We're not done that?
No, apparently not. It's just the thing that keeps on coming. Yeah, yeah, but before we get into that, we need to thank everyone who contributes every month or annually to keep the show going. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/Politicos. Let's jump right into COVID. So a lot has happened in the past couple weeks since we did our last show, which was all the way back on the 16th of December. So since then, the federal government has brought back the PCR test requirement for travelers. This had been lifted for people out of the country less than 3 days back in the fall. That got brought back. They also canceled the travel restrictions that they put in place for the 10 African countries. These were the ones that were the first to report the Omicron variant and had a bunch of travel restrictions placed on them by Canada and the other countries. They turned out to be slightly less effective than hoped for because, as I think we're all pretty aware at this point, the variant got around pretty quick. So as part of the response to that, the government has undone the now pretty ineffective travel restrictions.
Well, I think this was a good decision the second time around, right? It's just like that meme, the second best time to make that decision is right now. And so the government eventually realized that. And it was extremely uncomfortable for a couple of days there. This already seems like a long time ago, but where Canada was banning travelers from South Africa, but not from, say, places like the Netherlands, even though it was clear that the first cases documented once we started to figure out where Omicron was and when, that there were cases appearing in the Netherlands around the same time, perhaps even a little bit earlier than they were appearing in South Africa. So it was not effective from a healthcare public policy standpoint, given that the Omicron was almost certainly already in Canada as well, but also racism as a policy too. At least it's hard to justify the blocking of travelers from some countries, not others, when the same situation presents itself.
Yeah, this was one of those cases where it really does seem that the government, while reacting, I think, quicker than they had in a lot of the past cases, did so in a bit of a scattershot way and almost more for the public opinion aspects of it. Because, yeah, we did see the first cases being reported out of South Africa and Botswana, and the government kind of jumped on that before figuring everything else out. And that's the sort of thing that's probably needs to happen in a pandemic or just a general emergency situation. But in order for those quick responses to be effective, you actually have to reassess pretty quickly and see if that's actually working in this case.
Yeah, there is conceivably a way that you would put in travel restrictions, but it would be hard to be as choosy as the government was attempting to be. You want to stop people from coming into the country with COVID, you almost have to stop people from coming into the country. And so in the countries that have maintained those policies effectively, it's a pretty hard border, and there's real requirements for quarantining and so on. And it's not really allowing travelers from some parts of the world and not others. And if you're allowing travelers from the United States, you're allowing travelers from just about any other place in the world, or people who have had contact with other people in the world. So as long as it's committed to having something of a porous border with the United States, I tend to think that border restrictions are never going to be an effective strategy. It's just hard to maintain a hard Swiss cheese border, as it were.
We did try earlier with the pandemic or travel quarantining, but the way we did it here was so slapdash that it was just hard to actually effectively get enough people to quarantine to ever really make it effective.
Yeah, I think when we look back on this, and know how we'll laugh, but when we're looking back on sort of the most effective strategies, we're going to see, I think, that there's more than one way to have an effective strategy, and more than one way for governments to tackle the COVID problem. And Canada's strategy has, in some ways, been to try to solidify the population here through things like very widespread vaccinations, and perhaps not setting out to have a pretty porous border, but having a pretty porous border. The intertwinedness of our economy with the United States and the unwillingness to keep people from traveling back and forth, say who have property in the United States throughout the pandemic, has really made it so that we couldn't make a fortress Canada in the way that we see some other countries, particularly island countries like New Zealand, maintain their borders. And so I think when we look back, we will see, and we can lose sight of this, there are some things that Canada has done reasonably well, and there are other things that we tried and failed to do, and then other things that are just not very feasible to do without significantly restricting Canadian movements and things like that. And so these values, these trade-offs are there in a number of different ways. And I think we're going to have to do a fair amount of work trying to unpack what was reasonable trade-offs being made, what was just bad policy decisions or a lack of rapidity of response, and what was a combination of the two. It would help, and I think we're going to come back to this point in a few minutes, it would help if governments talked a bit more about what they're trying to do and why and how, because then we would have a sounder basis to try to evaluate some of these policy decisions about, say, why would we be isolating travelers from some countries and not others.
Yeah, I completely agree on that. I do hope we see Royal Commission or something sort of inquiry along those lines, as we really do need a full and very detailed review of everything that's happened in the pandemic from start to finish. And just before we move off the travel restrictions thing, I think I will also note that just the type of virus, I think, also plays a role into it, and just the properties that has. I think the travel restrictions may have been effective on the, or more effective with the original variant early in the pandemic when it was not ubiquitous, where there were, you still could have perhaps isolated it to smaller areas. But at this point, particularly with the very high effectiveness of the Omicron variant, it just seems harder than it was before to put in an effective travel policy that's going to deliver real results.
Yeah, I think we are grappling with this idea that in some ways COVID, we're not dealing with our parents' COVID. This is a new kind of situation. Our former
selves. Yeah. But the feds aren't the only ones responding to this. The provincial government's done a bunch as well. So the week leading up to Christmas, kind of throughout there, early in that week, December 20th, 21st, they brought in a bunch of new restrictions that will run until the 18th, but in all likelihood will probably extend past that. So they've prevented indoor organized social events and gatherings of any sizes, concerts, sports, games, theaters are at 50% reduced capacity regardless of venue size. Gyms, fitness centers, and dance studios are closed, as are bars and nightclubs, and restaurants are back to limiting table sizes and require an increased distancing.
These are the kinds of restrictions where, and we've seen something in close to despair, and I think a lot of us have felt that with the replacement or the institution of some of these restrictions, where it it's restrictions like this that make it feel like we are back in March 2020 once again. And it just, as we were saying, that's not entirely the case, but it is, I think, a certain aspect of this moment we're in, where it feels as if we are just stuck in the mud, and where we were 6 months ago, looking, say, hopefully to a time when most people are vaccinated, we're starting to grapple with the fact that we are transitioning. We're moving into a new phase of the pandemic, but there's not going to be this clean on-off switch between when we're in a pandemic and when we're out of it, and we're going to have moments like this. And I think one thing we might want to talk a bit about is just the frustration that this causes among some in the population, even as others are rightfully really still concerned about the health implications of the pandemic. And we see that tension there in just about any debate over policy. Are we not doing too much? Or for some who really are just ready to get back on with their lives, are we doing entirely too much? And again, this idea of what is the goal here, short term and long term, and having clear communications from governments at the provincial to the federal level is not necessarily there to help people understand exactly what we're doing and why, and what we can expect going forward.
Yeah, so particularly around the time these particular restrictions were announced, there was a pretty big discussion, it seemed like, in a lot of places about whether or not people were done with the pandemic. And obviously, wishing the pandemic was over doesn't make it. But there was really, I think, that sense of despair you were talking about, and that the, oh God, this what now feeling, plus the, I think, feeling of inevitability that came with it. And if anything, that was probably what really drove that sense that kind of no matter what would be done, we were all going to get exposed to the variant. Bunch of us were going to get sick, and booster shots would help. The having your first two shots definitely helps on the severity of the infection, but it was going to happen. People were just no longer able to actually avoid it, no matter how much they did. I think really did hammer home that feeling of despair that related to that. Plus the not just the script, the futility of it, I think, really connected in there. And that also connects in with what you were saying, where there's never really a sense of kind of what the goal was, what the exit strategy, I think, if anything, was probably the way to phrase that. Like, how were we going to get out of this? Because the implicit bargaining that was made with Canadians was, get your two shots, and you can more or less go back to normal with taking some precautions. And obviously things never really fully lifted, but there's definitely a sense that if you had your two doses, you were more or less okay. Yeah, Delta had some higher risk of breakthrough infections, but people were mostly okay even in those circumstances. And that just changed with the latest variant that does have a lot more immune escape.
Yeah. I think that cynicism, we see that in even in some messaging. There was some comments from Jason Kenney suggesting, you just hope that when people get it, the sort of inevitability of it, you hope it'll be a mild case, and some seeming resistance to putting in place any additional restrictions that the populations are not going to put up with it. And I think this comes back to this idea of what kind of message governments are giving people about where we are in the pandemic. And even if we don't have a clear exit strategy, this is a situation full of uncertainties. We didn't know Omicron was coming, although we knew likely another variant was coming. Another aspect of that international dimension, which we haven't talked about, and we don't, I think, talk about enough in Canada, is One of the keys to some sort of long-term strategy to getting out of a pandemic towards a more tolerable, steady state is to vaccinate the world and to be a leader in international vaccination efforts. And there are ways we could try to build a larger conversation rather than trying to restrict travel across borders. So to get back to that one world approach, and not even out of a sense of altruism. This is about how do we help ourselves and to be more active on that front would be one way we could do that. But we don't really have, even on a more local level, that articulation that what could be an exit strategy, perhaps not even an exit strategy, that the kinds of messaging that we would hear early in the pandemic, if we cast our minds way back to early 2020, when we were entering into those cautious reopenings in the summer of 2020 and so on, we had a pretty clear sense from governments about why we were doing this at this stage of the pandemic, and then when we were hoping to get to that being a little more openness, and what kinds of markers we would look at, and when that process might need to reverse itself, there was hope that it wouldn't reverse itself, what would be the kinds of triggers for that. And that kind of messaging is really out the window at this point. It's a sense of trying to hold on as long as we can without new restrictions, and when we can't hold on any longer, then we put in these new restrictions, and we try to hold on without additional restrictions. And we're going through that process right now with schooling in BC. So we have these closures with regard to public venues. We are currently going to have public schools, elementary schools staying open in BC, but we're just going to hold on to that as long as we can, and then we're not going to anymore. But without a clear sense of what the cutoffs are, and that this may happen very quickly, the situation may evolve very quickly, and to some extent that's owing to the uncertainty of the situation that we're in. But we could be a little more clear in terms of what is that evolving situation looking like? Is it going to be a particular kind of ICU capacity reached or a broader hospital capacity? Because we don't see quite as many people in the ICUs as we did with previous iterations of the virus. And so I think there's this real space and a real need to contextualize the current policies that we're implementing in the short term, and to place that into a context in terms of a larger term vision of where are we going as a society in the era of COVID, in which I don't think is going to end. We see more discussion within scientific communities of what it will look like potentially when we get to a more endemic state where coronavirus is hanging around, but not necessarily quite so disruptive as it is now. And we know, just as you were referring to, some of those strategies like ensuring vaccination as widespread as possible, boosters are widespread as possible, and seeing broader vaccination around the world, those are the keys to moving towards something like that, along with perhaps the effects of additional waves of COVID, which is demoralizing to realize, but that is part of the story as well. We don't really know where we're going. We're just getting different messages about cracking down, closing things, or restricting some things, and hoping the wave will pass by and we can relax a little bit. I'd really love a conversation about what are we trying to do with these different suites of policies. Are we trying to focus on hospitalization still? What are we doing in the short term? And then what kind of vision do governments have for what we are aiming for in the long term, so that we can see how the short term restrictions will then perhaps play into some sort of longer-term, more steady state that clearly an exhausted population is waiting for.
Yeah, and it really does feel like the communications out of the government and the public health officer, who I will also mention, echoed what you said, Kenny said, basically everyone's going to get it or get exposed to it at some point. Really, the trick is to be vaccinated so you have as good a chance of dealing with it as you can. That was Dr. Henry's statements earlier, I guess technically last month, on that. But yeah, it does feel like it's a day-to-day managing, but without kind of that longer-term vision or that longer-term plan. And I think that's particularly noticeable when the just manage to get through the day and don't worry so much about this one. Trying to the changing testing in the province. So, what, November earlier, the federal government had procured a bunch of rapid tests, sent them to the province, and there was questions on why BC wasn't using them. There were a couple different things said, one of them being, well, they came in big crates and we can't open them and distribute them effectively, which we poked fun at the time on that, so no need to belabor the point. But there's that, and then the other big thing was that PCR tests are significantly more accurate. The rapid tests don't give people the details they need or the information they really need, because they're too high an error rate on those. And yet, as of the week of the 20th of December, that all seemed to change on a dime, which I think was particularly disconcerting for a lot of people, because when the province switched to giving out rapid tests instead of PCR tests and reserving the more accurate PCR tests just for healthcare workers and people in vulnerable positions. That caught a lot of people off guard. I was actually in line for a test when I found that out because nobody had made an announcement at that point, but the testing site at St. Vincent's early that week handed out rapid tests for people and told them, yeah, take the rapid test, and if your rapid test comes back negative, you're good to go, and that's it. And that just seemed to contradict everything that was said by the government up to that point, and you're just left wondering, okay, what's really the case here, and does the government and the public health officer actually have a firm grasp of the situation, or is this kind of a cover-your-ass moment by them because we didn't invest in the testing capacity that we actually needed for this variant?
I'm sure that there is some truth to both those versions of the story. We know that Omicron, when it spread through the population, it was like wildfire. I mean, that the numbers that we see spiking case daily case counts across the country are not even capturing due to these testing issues that many of the cases that are showing up. And so it's not surprising that we are seeing a system pushed to the brink in terms of its testing capacity. And I think one of the issues in the background here, which is fair to acknowledge, but also it puts the public health authorities in a bit of a bind, but to acknowledge that systems are at capacity and there just isn't, say, lab capacity. There aren't the people, the spaces, the human capacity to process the test at the rate we would need with the PCR tests. It's possible they could have put in place additional staff, but one of the things in the background here is that this is a system that has been going just about full tilt or beyond full tilt for 2 years now. And as they try to bring on new capacity in some areas, we're also seeing attrition in others where people are getting burnt out. And the government is just trying to hang on here. And when we see a new variant pop up and overwhelm testing capacity, suddenly things that didn't seem perhaps good enough by one metrics are suddenly they're the only option on the table. And so they don't look so bad. And to try to explain that situation, I don't think government's allowed to share that kind of story, but that certainly fits the facts for what we've seen here. And more action to try to train and to bring on the stream additional capacity would have stood us in good stead here. But one of the things we have to accept is that systems are going to be overwhelmed at times. And I guess that's what we're dealing with here. But explaining that to people might make it a little better so that you're not finding out when you're standing in line around Christmas that the test that you're hoping to get is actually going to be the test that you were told a week ago is not good enough.
Yeah, I think that's what bothered me the most about that was the kind of feeling like the rug got pulled out from under oneself on that with the testing. But also, I think there is something to what you're saying on the system's overwhelmed and there has been quite a bit of strain on it. But you've got to wonder why we accepted that as where we were going to end up on this. So the system for BC's testing capacity is roughly 20,000 tests a day, which sounds like a lot, but has obviously nowhere near enough based on the current demand on it. But also, it's just a relatively small amount. We're a big province. There are 5 million of us, and it takes a long time to test 5 million people if you're doing 20,000 tests a day. On that, with the capacity we built, we could only test 0.04% of the population. And yes, this was a challenge, but it's a foreseeable challenge and a foreseeable problem. And you got to wonder why the government felt that a system that could only test 0.4% of the population was going to be sufficient, particularly with the known risk of variants. The first variant popped up over a year ago now, and I remember back early in the days of the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about a war effort footing. In the U.S., there was discussions of the Defense Production Act and equivalent talk up here. And yet that never really seemed to have been followed through on. Why did the government not procure more capacity than 20,000 tests? Now, I don't know the ins and outs of doing a PCR test, but I got to imagine 24 months is enough time to give someone a crash course on how to run a PCR test. There's probably a lot of background stuff that you want a normal lab tech to know, but like you said, it's an emergency, and in an emergency, you make do or find other options. And so far, the system, and not just the system, but the apparatus around it, has not been as flexible as we would need it to be in emergency situations. And that kind of war effort mentality never really manifested itself. If this was World War II, it would not have taken 24 months to stand up some extra capacity on a lot of things. If there was any way to do it quicker, we would have done it quicker. But that urgency never really seemed to have actually happened here. And it's got to wonder why the government felt that they didn't need to plan for a worst-case scenario, or even just a slightly worst-case scenario than they had experienced in the first wave.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one of those cases where a little more communication around what are the real constraints on policy would be helpful. So it's entirely possible, and we just don't know, that the government went to considerable lengths to try to develop additional capacity and either wasn't successful or there was additional attrition along the same time, so they've really just been treading water. We're also trying to see where we're seeing a government that is pretty clearly trying to balance different values. There is a certain sense in which there is an attempt to try to continue life as usual, to move away from an emergency footing and to try to get to a steady state where systems can persist, where there is a limited amount of spending on health services to try to pay attention to other needs. And certainly the government is there is no shortage of other challenges for the government to attend to, whether it's climate related or whether it's weather related, or and then obviously those two are related to one another. The lack of attention on other persistent issues in society with regard to housing, with regard to poison drugs. Like, there's all kinds of things government can be doing, and it seems like we do see governments trying to treat this as one challenge among many, and to wherever possible maintain the normal way of doing things for as much of society as possible. And I would really relish hearing governments talk a little more openly about how they're trying to balance these different values, and to talk a bit more openly about some of the challenges they've encountered, and that might help us get context around why testing has been so limited, and why we would see this evolving communication around, say, the use of rapid tests and so on, because we do know that they are less effective. They can give false negatives. They can give false positives. We also know that they are better than a straw in the wind. They are a useful tool, and to see governments and BC's most lately embrace them is evidence of that fact. And just to have more openness and communication, I think, would solve a number of problems for government. And that with regard to case counts and how cases are being counted, with regard to the specificity of the data provided. There is an ongoing challenge regarding transparency in Canada and in BC. And in some ways, that is up to the government's own disadvantage, because we end up having these questions, we end up seeing critiques of government competence, when the reality, the situation behind it, may have some kind of explanation, but we just don't know because we don't have the information, we don't have the data, we don't have the transparency of the story behind it.
True, although I will point out that there are other countries that are testing at a higher per capita rate than we are, so I'm not sure we're necessarily at the limit of the possible here. There probably is some room, probably some fairly significant room for improvement, but the point of the transparency is well taken. And I don't know, I keep coming back, and this is something that I've come back to time and time again during this pandemic, is trying to just imagine how the NDP would have been responding to this if they were in opposition and the Liberals were still running things when the pandemic hit. And I don't know, I just cannot for the life of me see the premier, who would be leader of the opposition in this case, or Adrian Ditz, or any of those people as opposition critics, or the rank and file partisans being happy with this. There would have been outrage over the government cheaping out, not investing in fighting the pandemic properly, the stuff leveled at other premiers in the country. And yeah, I just keep wondering how the people who are defending the government's record on stuff like this, like, and defending a government that didn't invest the resources necessary or find ways around the bottlenecks that there may be on this one, how they are rationalizing this. Because, you know, having watched a lot of them during the years when their party was not running things, I would expect that had the partisan shoes been on the other foot here, the critiques and anger and dissatisfaction with the government would be coming fast and furious here. And I don't know, it seems to me like, particularly for the NDP, who are in theory the party of the government doing everything, should be trying a lot harder to actually have the government succeed at the stuff it's trying to do. And that just hasn't seemed to have happened in practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's certainly, there are things government could be doing more of. And that includes additional testing, and that it does include both, you know, the explanation piece I was already talking about. But in terms of the actual response time, we know that there is a real attrition of the inability to maintain capacity in terms of nursing and so on. These are issues where the government is treading water, and we do see a system that is creaking a little bit. We know governments put in place additional restrictions when the overall integrity of the health system is threatened by the spike in cases and potential hospitalizations to follow. And so we do know that this is a government under pressure, and that these are systems under pressure. It's ultimately, I think, going to be to the government's detriment. It does get a bit of a free pass, though, you know, when it comes to the current opposition, where it doesn't seem like the BC Liberals are able to make much hay of these issues, where they're still very internally focused. And it is an interesting thing where governments that were really almost responding in good faith to the pandemic and in the early months bought themselves an enormous amount of goodwill and good credit with voters, and that seems to persist on even years into the pandemic. BC's response has not always been as effective as other provinces. For all the criticism of, say, of Ontario's government, at times case counts have considerably outstripped Ontario's. We don't always see as effective a response here. But the criticism of the Ford government in Ontario far outstrips on a regular basis what we hear leveled against the BC governments here. And so it is an interesting thing where we do see muted criticism, where perhaps there ought to be a little more focus and a little more critique around particular decisions regarding communication of cases, particular hotspots. We know it's been like pulling teeth to get specific data to allow people to make their own decisions and to find out more about what efforts have been made to stand up testing capacity and why more was not invested. Those are all questions that are good to ask, and I think we'd all like to have more answers to them. But in the current political environment in BC, we don't seem to see that kind of pressure. I mean, the NDP government is fairly comfortable, and the BC Liberals don't seem to be in a position to make them terribly uncomfortable in the near future.
Yeah, that's true. The Liberals definitely have a bunch of rebuilding work to do, and they're probably not going to be fully effective as an opposition until that finishes off. And a big part of that is they're still in a leadership race at this point, and we're about a month away from that wrapping up, which, I don't know, maybe this is another example of why long leadership races are a bad thing, because it has meant the party has been focused internally for months now, be a year when all is said and done there. And Shirley Bond's done an admirable job as an interim leader, you know, holding the party together, being fairly effective in the ledge, but interim leaders can only do so much, and you do need the permanent leader in place, and taking a quarter of a term, particularly in a situation where there has been a lot going on, from the heat dome over the summer to the ongoing pandemic to the more recent disasters that have afflicted the province, and having the opposition party be fully engaged with that is something that we want to see happen. And this long-term trend towards nine-month or longer leadership races just is not great on that respect. And I don't know why parties seem so interested in doing so, because there's no outside force pushing them to or making them do this. It's internal decisions from the Liberals or the Conservatives, and I guess we'll see what happens with the Liberals when Justin Trudeau eventually leaves. But all of these things together make it just hard to actually have an effective opposition at a time where we need it, because there's absolutely stuff to hold the government to account to, both from what we've been talking about for the past 40 minutes or so, as well as issues around, say, access to information, which ties into this. There's a piece in the Cahier, which we'll throw linked to in the show notes, from Amanda, a reporter there, basically just documenting her efforts to get some basic information and the year-long saga that was around what was the impact of outbreaks at work camps on the surrounding areas. And just reading through it, it is clear that the government is not being effective at responding to these inquiries or processing them in an effective manner. And that was before they threw up even more barriers in the latest reforms to the access to information.
Yeah, I think when we look back on this era of the NDP, they are going to be criticized for a few things, but their unwillingness or inability to handle information and to make information accessible to voters and to the media that are the conduit for voters to access that information is going to be one of the major criticisms of this government. It creeps up again and again, and we see it filtering out through other institutions that are guided by government. The emphasis on privacy over access to information has been risen to the point of impairing our ability to understand the public health security issues that we are facing, and it's not really clear that anything is gained from it, and it's not clear that even the government is going to gain from it in the long term. We could develop a reputation for being so miserly with information and so unwilling to communicate anything. I mean, we've seen governments, we've seen voters sour on governments like that. I mean, it's a little hint of Stephen Harper about that unwillingness to allow any information to leak out, or it's just where you have to pry it out of the government's hands, and then now you perhaps even have to pay to lodge a freedom of information request. It's not a great look for a government, and I think an opposition that was firing on all cylinders, as you say, would be able to make more of this situation. It's a bit of a tangent, but I think one of the reasons parties may look for that longer leadership review or leadership campaign when they are in a period where they feel like they need to rebuild, or they need to make sure that they're making the right choice. They want to avoid a front runner simply running a quick victory lap and sewing up the leadership. Then there are reasons to perhaps take a little more time with the leadership race, but that always assumes that you're going to have a thorough airing of issues, of different philosophies that the party might opt for in terms of how to move forward. Leaders shape the direction of the party in such an important way. It is a great opportunity for parties to talk over what they stand for, but then the leadership candidates themselves have to make use of that space to engage in that kind of debate.
And that has not exactly been the case this time around. Most of the debates can probably be summarized as violent agreement between all the candidates, with one or two barbs at most in there. And it's just not being the case that these long leadership races, and I'm thinking both the current BC Liberal one as the conservative leadership race that selected Erin O'Toole, or the one before that with, actually no, the one before that there was reasonably broad policy discussions on those, but the Erin O'Toole one for sure, the 2020 one, neither of those really aired out those discussions too much or in an effective way. And there's also just built in there the assumption that the party members are at large are the best group to make those selections. And I don't know, I've watched enough of the US primaries to see the challenges with that approach. And I think the way we structure a lot of the parties structure them here with the riding weighted systems can help offset that slightly, but there is a challenge where the things the very engaged party voters care most about are not necessarily things that resonate with the broader public. And I don't think any party's really done a great job of reconciling those contradictions.
No, there's any way that a government, or sorry, a party chooses to choose their leader, there are going to be problems with it. And I think one of the ironies of the recent federal leadership campaign between O'Toole and Peter McKay was that there was a debate over ideas, and O'Toole articulated a fairly populist stance, and then once he won, he quickly pivoted away from it. So there was a debate about ideas, and those ideas were abandoned. And in some ways, O'Toole treated it, just to finish the thought, almost like an American primary, like you're talking about, where you say one thing to win the leadership, and then you pivot for the general. That is a tried and true American strategy. We don't see it much in Canadian politics, and it seems like Mr. O'Toole paid a bit of a penalty for it, but he may yet get another kick of the can, so we'll see if second time's a charm for him.
Mm-hmm. The true blue may have won the leadership race, but it was not the ideas that ultimately emerged out of it. So yeah, that's going to be an interesting one to watch. But before we move on to actually circle kind of around to the U.S., is there anything else on COVID you'd want to touch on before advance to the next story?
Just to come back to this idea of, I try to understand that governments are facing challenges and they're facing constraints. And this is a situation with a great deal of uncertainty. And I think it's worth noting that. And it's also worth noting that we are all in some ways facing our own private pandemics at this point, where something of that social response has eroded away. We see people falling into different camps about how they're going to respond. And in part, that's because we don't have as strong a message from government about where we are and what the known knowns are about the current response, and what are the unknown, the known unknowns, and what are the unknown unknowns, to use Donald Rumsfeld from, about where we hope to get to and what we are hoping to do to get us to that point. We referenced Bonnie Henry's comments, end of year comments, talking about what it might look like as BC moves towards a more endemic form of the coronavirus, where more people have the illness, but they have the protections put in place through things like double vaccination and boosters to be able to come through that process and that illness in better, much better shape than they would have in earlier eras of this pandemic. If that's the kind of vision that we're working towards, and that it would be useful to hear governments just talk through that process of what are we actually aiming for, rather than simply happy talk of go and get your boosters and do your part and we'll all get through this together. Yeah, but we have some people who are really looking to move on with their lives. We see that mask usage is not what it once was. We see people are embracing all kinds of riskier behavior, and others are still living very cautious lives, and people are sort of choosing their own pandemic. And so having governments come back and reassert, so what stage are we in, and how are we going to move from here to some sort of future, more stable future, would be really helpful to lay out what that roadmap looks like in theory, even as we know there is a great deal of uncertainty in that. I would really encourage governments to try to lay out that that larger term, big picture, sort of strategic context for where we are and where we're going. And that will help people make sense of things like short-term restrictions that are currently in place to understand if we've gone through these double vaccinations and everything was supposed to be okay, and now it's not exactly, although when we get sick, we're not necessarily as getting as sick as before. Some people are still getting quite sick. Enough people are getting quite sick that we need to be aware of ICU capacities, and so we're going to restrictions in the short term, but then we're going to get to this other state, and it may not be perfect. We're not going to necessarily ever see an end to COVID, but we're going to enter this endemic stage. And here's what it will look like when we get there in certain broad strokes, and we don't know how long it will take to get there exactly. But this is the goal we're actually striving towards, and these are the short-term challenges that we have, and those are the long-term challenges that we have in order to get to that place. And that creates a frame in which they can discuss all the different issues that we've talked about in this conversation so far, whether it's testing limitations, capacity limitations, why they did not invest more, were they investing strategically elsewhere, because they don't anticipate needing a great deal of testing capacity in the future. Is that where we're at? Then let's have that conversation. But just putting in place a general scaffolding of here's the long-term goal, here's the near-term challenges, here are the values that we are trying to balance and counterbalance. We're trying to protect some vulnerable populations. We're trying to maintain healthcare capacity. We're trying to create as much space as possible for people to continue to live their lives, because clearly governments are trying to do that by keeping large venues open half capacity. That's hard to square up with things like trying to maintain small bubbles for your Christmas vacations and cutting back vacation plans and so on. But just trying to understand, why are we doing these two seemingly contradictory things at the same time? What are we trying to accomplish here? Put that conversation out. And to say we are trying to create space for some people to live lives that they are comfortable with, they are vaccinated enough to be able to engage in some of those activities, like going out to dine at all. But we're also trying to protect infrastructure and health capacity and so on in the short term. So we also want to be really careful about how we do that, and really giving people the trusting to do with that information what they need to keep themselves safe and to make informed choices would be really helpful. And I don't think we really have that scaffolding. We hear reactive messaging where things are bad and we're hoping they'll get better in the near future. We hear musings in long form interviews with Dr. Henry about some sort of longer term view, but put that into a policy. Let us see where we're going, and I think we would all not necessarily be happier, but at least we know where we are and what are our actual choices and what we can shape our expectations accordingly.
Yeah, I agree with that more. There's definitely a leadership vacuum going on here, and in that vacuum, there's a lot of people filling in the blanks or trying to decide for themselves. And something that I don't think has been well talked about is that everyone does have different levels of risk tolerance, but without that kind of clearly articulated leadership and kind of outline of what we're doing and why, people have been left to try and slot their own personal risk tolerance in there. And yeah, it leads to a lot of tension, particularly because, well, neither, I don't really want to call them sides, but neither of the two poles of the range of views on this seem particularly accepting that there are different risk tolerances distributed around the population. And yeah, it's a tough one. And there really does need to be, I think, a strong leadership role shown pretty much across the board, from locally all the way up to the prime minister. And there just hasn't really been enough of that going on here. And that's, I think, one of those long-term challenges. And it's a challenge that isn't just around COVID either. It's a broader issue in our political culture.
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. And I also think it's not even Canada-specific, where we do see... We see governments around the world, they are adapting. We know that people are thinking about the pandemic in a policy environment differently than they were a year ago. When we see the CDC in the United States suddenly pivot, saying, you used to have to isolate for 10 days, and now actually five is good. Five is fine. And just wear a mask. They're just suddenly changing the rules on people. And without a real articulation of what are those competing values, and we've again in the United States case, we heard some of that messaging from Dr. Fauci saying, well, we were just trying to find rules that people will put up with, is kind of what he said. So that's okay, but it also can tend to undermine people's confidence in government. when we what we were talking about with the testing, where you're telling us one thing and then you tell us another thing, and we don't get the story about why have we had to change what we were being told from one moment to the next. If you are of the sort to be feeling questioning whether government is doing enough to respond to the pandemic, you're going to really question the motives of a government that is suddenly relaxing its response. If you are the type to say that government perhaps is being overly restrictive here and keeping people from living their lives, then they may undermine your trust in anything the government says at all. And so you don't follow any policy recommendations. And looking around society, that they're, it's not a majority, but you do see people out there who clearly have taken that choice and they're not following mass recommendations and so on. And so the more that government would seem to be changing on a dime, changing under some sort of unspoken pressure or unarticulated pressure without giving us that scaffolding about, here's what we're trying to balance out, here are the competing values that we're trying to reconcile, there's no one right answer here, and then giving people the information to understand where do they fit into this story, it can lead to that kind of cynicism where people will give up and say, yeah, everybody's going to get it, so I'm not going to even try, or to say this government has not got my best interests in at heart, and I've got to, you know, I've got to live a life of isolation and to really not trust what government is saying about additional restrictions. And so a government that cannot communicate that vision is in danger of becoming less credible in the eyes of people for different reasons, but it's the same as
south of the border. So in the lead up to January 6th and the anniversary of the storming of the U.S. Capitol building, there's been a lot written about it, and I just wanted to highlight a couple pieces around, particularly in the Canada's context on there. There's a big piece in the Globe and Mail earlier this week from political scientist Thomas Homer Ditson, basically about how the American polity is under stress, cracking, and what Canada must do to prepare. And the article mostly spends the time going through the U.S. challenges, which I don't think really need to be reiterated. But it's a topic that I don't think Canada's really wrestled with that much. We, after Trump got elected, we put a lot of effort into trying to keep the trading relationship open, but we don't seem to have had that same sense of urgency, or that sense of urgency seems to have evaporated after Trump left office, despite the fairly significant damage left in the wake, and more concerning, the ongoing trends, starting with the issues around the counting of the election and some of the stuff we're seeing, the continued radicalization of Republicans and stuff, and just it would seem prudent for Canada to prepare for a scenario where the U.S. undergoes some version of significant strain to outright political chaos or collapse. And I'm not seeing really those signs there. And it doesn't really seem like Canada's fully utilizing kind of the 2 to 4 year window we have to prepare for a world where the U.S. may no longer be the reliable trading partner or ally, or even just a stable country on a border with 10 times our population.
I think we really need to take these kinds of considerations seriously. This article in the Globe and Mail by Thomas Homer Ditson. Homer Ditson is a political scientist. He's known for taking big swings. And he likes to be, you could almost call him a bit of a futurist. So he looks at long-term trends and tries to extrapolate. So he looked at the possibility of climate change leading to an increased conflict, so environment caused conflict around the world. And so the fact that he is writing about this does not mean that it is automatically going to happen, but it's certainly not him. I think this is something Canada needs to take seriously. It's the idea that in the wake of 2016, even putting aside the considerations of 2020, from 2016 onward, there's an awareness that the window of possibilities for the kind of leader that the United States would elect is a broader range of possibilities, and some of those possibilities are not going to be committed to democracy, to democratic values, liberal values. and the events of early 2021. It's the anniversary on the day of recording here of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. So we have a dramatic symbol there. The idea that not everyone in the United States, a significant portion of the population, is not committed to the idea of democratically electing government. They're committed to the idea of getting their person elected, their person in office. And so that's something that Canada has to be aware of. Canadians have to be aware of. And we have to plan accordingly. We can't count on United States being this tent pole of a Western liberal alliance. Those may not be the values of a future leader of the country. So what do we do? Canada has to plan accordingly, whether it thinks about ways to try to influence American domestic policy, that is, or domestic politics. That's a potentially quite dangerous game. I don't know if that's going to work out in Canada's advantage, to try to find ways to encourage the country to tend towards a democratic outcome. We would all like to see that happen, but it's not clear how much outsiders can do realistically on that front. And then it's a question of how does Canada respond? How do we position ourselves in terms of foreign policy, in terms of our own trading policy, in terms of border issues, in terms of what kinds of alliance we want to build around the world to try to give Canada different diplomatic, trading, security options? If we need to go it alone, what does that mean? And so we're going to have that conversation, I think, at an increasing volume over the next 3 years and then run up to 2024, which is shaping up to be just a terrifying year.
Definitely terrifying. I'm hoping we see more of that conversation, other than the brief bits in the past week or so, spurred on by the timing of this and the January 6th date approaching. I haven't actually seen a huge amount of it over this past year, and that's been somewhat unfortunate, because these are big changes we would need to do to prepare. Our military and security is deeply tied into the U.S. structures on that, and that has been to Canada's benefit and something we should not abandon, but we also do need to make plans if that's no longer going to be in our interest or going to be as reliable on that. And those changes and reforms take a long time to implement, as does building the diplomatic and international relations with allies in forums that the U.S. isn't as involved in, as well as dealing with trying to shift or close the gap in terms of the disparities between the two country sizes, economically, population-wise, and all that. Part of the reason this is so concerning, beyond just the general, it's bad when democracies collapse or fail, is that the U.S. is just so much bigger than us, and that makes it really hard to keep the effects of whatever's happening in the U.S., keep those effects to a minimum here in Canada. And long term, we should be trying to get to a point where we're, you know, not one-tenth the size of the U.S., but significantly smaller disparity between the two. But that sort of thing, trying to build towards a population of 100 million or more, does not happen quickly. But we absolutely need to be thinking about that long term, because we can't know for sure that 10 years, 15, 20, even 4 from now, that's the U.S. is not going to be causing us a lot of problems.
I think we're going to need more houses.
Some of us are working on that, trying to get that. That's a challenge here that actually makes, like, just our own local land use policies have some spillover effects, and that it's hard to grow the population or even just attract the talent that otherwise would have, that didn't go to the U.S. during the Trump years, that could have settled here and there were more blots to that, just because we have such a messed up housing system here in Vancouver and Toronto. And yeah, the housing theory of everything even has tendrils of bats on Canada's place in the world.
Vancouver's restrictive zoning laws are a threat to national security.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it is amazing how many things there. Housing policy has second and third order effects on.
There is a connectedness to all levels of policy here. I think Canada, and this is part of the conversation that is going to occur, whether it happens in a forward-leaning sort of way. And we've seen a few op-eds about what Canada is going to look like if it is increasingly either left to its own devices or under pressure from a less friendly United States. I mean, there are different scenarios we can consider. And so how is Canada going to orient itself and becoming more sufficient, becoming bigger? Those are different options Canada can look at, trying to become more aggressive on those fronts. We also have to think about our foreign policy. If the United States is no longer committed to this idea of a Western liberal project, which has had huge negative effects around the world in some parts of the world, but by and large has put Canada in good stead for the last 70-odd years, what is to become of this bedrock of Canadian foreign policy? Are we going to continue to be a voice for human rights and commitment to those kinds of values around the world? Are we going to become a trading country which only looks at what kinds of deals we can strike with other countries? Are we going to really turn inward and try to move away from the international stage? You can argue we've already done that to a certain extent. Do we need to reverse that inwardness and become more active internationally again? These are all options for Canada in a world which is not going to have that American leadership, which, whether people liked it or not, was the reality of the international community, and certainly in the non-communist bloc up until 1990, and since then, the whole world, effectively, is that order is broken down, and we are going to have a conversation, whether it's reactive or proactive, about what Canada is going to do in this new environment, where we don't really know where the U.S. will be from one election to the next. I hope to see more of that conversation. I hope to be a part of that conversation. And the sooner we can think about those seriously, and this will be another case where governments can provide leadership, and we are not seeing that kind of leadership yet. Not really even seeing the capacity for that kind of conversation from this federal government. I'm hopeful that will change, but it's going to have to change soon, or events will overtake us once again.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And yeah, we're not seeing the leadership either from the prime minister, his party, or the opposition leaders trying to push forward that leadership or encourage that conversation in an effective manner. It's just not really something that's being talked about too much in a kind of very serious public way in Canada, and that needs to change because, as we have seen a lot this year, not preparing for stuff doesn't make the challenge go away. And if anything, it just makes the damage worse, whether that's pandemics or climate-related flooding or the political instability from our...
Yep, that's true. And the hits are just going to keep on coming. So the sooner we can have these conversations, the better. Although, so far, Canada has been fairly lucky. We have not had those conversations in many cases because we haven't needed to. We have been... We are a North Atlantic power, the east side of the Pacific Ocean, which is a pretty lucky place for a country to be. We have not had a great deal of need to engage in those kinds of foreign policy discussions, forefronting those issues. And that's going to change if the American umbrella gets a little smaller and we don't have quite the protection that we once did.
Stuart, thanks for joining me tonight. I know we went a little on and we had to leave a few stories that we wanted to talk about on the cover room floor, but hopefully I get around to discussing those next week. But in the meantime, if people want to know more, follow you on Twitter or kind of find out more of your thoughts on the various things we talked about, where can they find you?
And they can always find me on Twitter, far too often on Twitter, at my name, Stuart Prest, and look forward to engaging with any and all there.
Yeah, and you're also in the Patreon Slack, and people are encouraged to sign up for our Patreon to get access to the Slack, which is a source of a lot of great conversations on everything we talked about tonight and a whole lot more. And you can support the podcast and get access to that at patreon.com/politicoast. Stuart, thanks for joining me tonight.
It was a pleasure. It's always a pleasure. And I do encourage people to join the Patreon and to get involved on the Slack. It is a fount of useful information and some back and forth. And if you are interested in the politics of Vancouver or BC or Canada or the Vancouver Canucks, there's something there for you. I have found it an immensely valuable tool. So I recommend it.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Polite Coast is a production of Lightning Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.